tonight on Arena. We'll be reviewing the Gate Theatre's production of Dancing at Lunasa. We'll be talking about the work of a legendary Italian screenwriter, and we've three new TV shows to review. You can text us on 51551 or you can tweet at RTE Arena. And first to this week's TV reviews. First up, we have Elsbeth on Sky Max and Now TV. This is a spin-off series taken from The Good Wife and The Good Fight. The series is based on Elsbeth, the perky and eccentric defence lawyer played by Carrie Preston. Lady in the Lake is the latest offering from Apple TV, which tells us the story of two women in 1960s Baltimore whose lives converge in sinister circumstances. It provides Natalie Portman with her first TV role as she plays Maddie Schwartz, a Jewish housewife whose loveless marriage is about to end. And Ronald Emmerich, the man who brought us Independence Day and The Day After Tomorrow, takes us to ancient Rome for Prime Video's Those About to Die, based on the book of the same name by Daniel P. Mannix and starring Anthony Hopkins. Our reviewers this evening joining me in studio, Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. You're both very welcome. Let's start with Elsbeth on Sky Max. Elsbeth, late at The Good Fight, as I mentioned, has moved to New York and has brought all her quirkiness with her as she arrives at her first crime scene dressed with a Statue of Liberty hat. So far, so very Elsbeth. Chris, fill us in a little on Elsbeth and why is she in New York? What's her mission?
She is there to be a de facto detective with the NYPD. So she was always this guest star, Elsbeth, played by Carrie Preston, in The Good Wife, and then actually its subsequent spin-off, The Good Fight. And she always provided a little bit of comic relief. I think the best thing about her was that we got her in small doses. But she made a big impact, enough to actually win an Emmy, Preston, that is, for her performance. So The Good Wife universe, if we're really going to call it that, is now expanding. So I think the creators, Richard King and Michelle King, they're kind of thinking, what other characters can we make a spin-off from? So Elsbeth now is in the spotlight. So she moves from Chicago to New York. She's there to assist the NYPD. There's been a series of controversial arrests recently, so she's going to investigate that. But she's also going to work as a detective. What the NYPD don't actually know is that she's there to investigate the people at the top. This alleged crooked captain, played by Wendell Pierce. But none of that is really important, because what we really actually have here is a murder of the week show. Not so much a whodunit, but a how catch him. You know, we have a different guest star every week, a starry cameo from like Stephen Moyer or Jen Krakowski or Keegan-Michael Key, where we see a murder happen in the first few minutes and then we spend the next 40 minutes waiting for Elsbeth to help a clueless NYPD to solve that murder.
And Jen, what do you make of this character, Elsbeth? I mean, does her character merit a whole series? There's that fine line, isn't there, between quirkiness and being really annoying?
There really is, because when you look at something like Cheers, you're thinking, how did Frasier become the spin-off of Cheers, like in that way? But they chose really well, because they chose this character that you didn't really know that much about, but you knew there was enough there within Kelsey Grammer to push out a whole season. But this is like if the spin-off of Frasier was about Bulldog, and you're kind of like, would you really want that wacky zaniness like all the time in your face for a good 40 minutes? And I think the success or the failure of this show depends on how you feel about Elsbeth as a character. Now, for me, I found her a bit too in your face, a bit too irritating. And I think the people around her, like Chris was saying, has these great guest stars that you're so surprised to see, and that people actually genuinely love, like, you know, someone like Jen Krakowski from 30 Rock.
She's,
you know,
gorgeous,
you can't
yeah.
not love her. And I think they make the show shine. But I think the problem is you're caught between this mystery of the week and this kind of unfunny sitcom. That's where the tone kind of unhappily lies. And I think post Only Murders in the Building, there has been this real ache, this real desire for America to get back to that kind of cozy crime. Like, you know, in the UK, you've everything, Vera, you've Midsommar Murders, but America, they're missing that Murder, She Wrote, the Columbo, the Quincy. Now, they got something like that starring Natasha Lyonne last year. They got Poker Face, Ryan Johnson's show, which was basically like a Columbo. It was, you know, her playing this kind of very witty drifter, dry drifter who, you know, ends up solving these murders. She has a little bit of a psychic feel to her. And that was done perfectly because it had this beautiful direction. It had these stories that kind of unfolded in a very clever way. I mean, they do show you up front who the murderer is, kind of like in those shows like Columbo always do.
Yeah.
But they did it with panache and a lot of flair, whereas this is a bit too simplistic, I think.
We'll come back to that in a moment. Let's take a little clip where in this clip we meet Elsbeth, played by Carrie Preston, as she arrives in New York and takes a tour bus to her first crime scene call and arrives still wearing a foam Statue of Liberty headdress.
I love New York. I've always wanted to live here. All those lights. Oh, it's magical. Oh, this is my stop.
You know, this is not an Uber.
Yeah, but you were heading up this way. Hi, I'm Elspeth Tassioni. I'm the thingy thing.
The thingy thing?
The outside observer.
I think you should,
Oh my God, I didn't even remember I was wearing that.
Yeah, that's Carrie Preston and Elspeth. And Chris, as Jen mentioned there, we sort of know who did it from the word go. We're not really guessing. Does that work? I mean, she has this sort of, oh, silly old me, I don't know anything, but yes, I do. But does it take from the tension of the episode?
It does a little bit. I always prefer the whodunit. I don't really want to know who the murderer is up front. But I actually think it comes to life with those guest performers. I actually think... like that's what kept me watching. Like Stephen Moyer in particular, like he's having an awful lot of fun here. I think he should have been given a mustache to twirl. And Keegan-Michael Key, Jane Krakowski, Jesse Tyler Ferguson. Those are some very difficult roles to play because you're showing the audience that you are 100% an irredeemable character in the opening sequence. So how to keep them interested over the next little while is to watch them actually believe that they might be able to get away with this, despite the fact that they're just leaving clues for the investigators left, right and centre. I thought that was, it is fun, but it is, as Jen said, like it's kind of like this awkward cross between Only Murders in the Building and Columbo, except Only Murders has those golden zingers. It has likability. It has a lot more charm. You know, Columbo was always a little bit trickier. You never really kind of knew where it was going to go until the final sequence. And I think it's weird too, because Carrie Preston's Elspeth, she sometimes doesn't even feel like a main character in her own show. Now that might be intentional because we do kind of move away from her. We do spend an awful lot of time with those guest stars. And I think that might be actually the king saying, we know that she's better in small doses. Yeah. We know that she can be a bit too eccentric and a bit too annoying after a while. But for whatever reason, this show has worked. We're only getting it on this side of the Atlantic now, but a second season is actually on the way in a couple of months. So the Good Wife universe keeps on, it's still quite popular apparently.
Okay, we'll get your stars on this. Very watchable, I think, Jen.
Very. It's a tidy little distraction. It's a well-made little brain holiday, and you could do worse than spending a couple of 40 minutes a night with her. So I'd say, maybe 2.5.
2.5 from Jen. What about you, Chris?
Yeah, it's frothy. It's cartoonish. It's a little bit of a sugar rush, I think, compared to some of the other shows that we'll be looking at tonight. I will go with a 3.
And a 3 from Chris. All right, that is Elspeth. Let's come next to Lady in the Lake, a new thriller series. This is on Apple TV. The plot revolves around two fictional cases inspired by real events, the murders of a Jewish girl and a black woman. Jen, we're in 1960s Baltimore here. Can you tell us a little bit about the premise of Lady in the Lake?
Yeah, so the basic plot revolves around two fictional cases, and they are both actually inspired by real events. But it's the murders of a young Jewish girl and a black woman. And when a young Jewish girl goes missing on Thanksgiving, it becomes this catalyst, this bomb that kind of explodes in the life of this Baltimore housewife, Maddie Schwartz, or Maddie Morgenstern, who's played by Natalie Portman. And she is just really exhausted from living up to those perfectionist standards that are imposed on women at the time, and she's just sleepwalking through this conventional life with her bullying husband, who's completely overbearing. He's played by Brett Gelman, who people would know from Stranger Things, and then her teenage son Seth. And Seth seems to be like curdling under the weight of his father's misogyny, and he seems to be lashing out more and more at Maddie under his influence. And her family seems like they have this very lack of concern, a very jovial nature of carrying on when this child goes missing. And the child is actually the daughter of a former sweetheart of Maddie's. And that when this happens, the already kind of nervous and jittery Maddie, she just loses it, really. And it ignites something inside her to leave her family. So she's running away, and she runs away to this apartment that's in this predominantly black neighbourhood to ostensibly find herself, but also reconnect with this person that she used to be, who used to write for the school newspaper, and who was this kind of maybe undiscovered star writer that never really pushed herself. And her story intertwines then with the life of Cleo, who's played by Moses Ingram, and she's the mother of two sons, and she is scrabbling to get by. And this is not a spoiler, but she is the Lady in the Lake.
We know that straight away.
She narrates the story from beyond the grave. And so just as Maddie dreamed of being a writer, Cleo dreamed of being a singer, but her passion was completely thwarted by her feckless husband, who's this wannabe stand-up comedian in a kind of Richard Pryor, sub-Richard Pryor mode, who's played by Byron Bowers. And his dreams took centre stage, whereas Cleo was left behind. And now she's working 3 jobs and, you know, involving herself in her community with this trail trailblazing black feminist senator, but she can't progress in that political sphere because she has this other job who's she's associating with this crime boss called Shell Gordon, who's played by The Wire's Wood Harris, and she works in his club cooking his books, basically. Yeah. So all those worlds are converging. So these are the two stories that you're getting.
Two big female
it.
Roles there. Yeah. And just before we come to the performances, Chris, let's take a little clip here. This is Cleo Johnson, played by Moses Ingram, speaking to Natalie Portman's character, Maddie, from The Dead.
I saw you once, Maddie Schwartz. Before any of this began, I saw you. Alive. I was Cleo Johnson. But in my death, I became the lady in the lake.
Yeah, it is fairly eerie. And, you know, when the child goes missing, I have to say it was pretty terrifying stuff. As we said, Chris, Natalie Portman taking her first TV role. How does she do in this?
Yeah, she does quite good. I mean, it's the greatest hits of Portman performances. I mean, you know, here's Natalie Portman freaking out. Here's Natalie Portman, you know, having an angry outburst. Here she is crying. You know, it's all of the great Natalie Portman performances in one television series. So, you know, that is a good thing. But I think far more interesting is Moses Ingram's character, Cleo. If that was the entire show, if basically we were following, you know, forget about the fact that Natalie Portman's character is kind of trying to run away from her privilege and very easily sets up the life that she should have had before she met her husband. For Cleo, it's not so easy. She's working three jobs just to keep a roof over her children's head. She's caught in a rock and a hard place because, you know, she wants to work for the, you know, future mayor of Baltimore, but the future mayor of Baltimore won't give her a position because of her gangster connections, but that's what she's trying to run away from. So everything she touches, it just never really works out for her. And she's so sick of being passed over and pushed around. And once we're following Cleo in that grounded story, or whenever we are following her in that story, it is quite good. And she is just exceptional in it. And also, I think she wasn't even in the first choice for this. Lupita Nyong'o was actually the first choice to star along Natalie Portman. So she would just make you forget about Lupita in this. She is so good. And that's not an easy thing to do. Yeah. I think the worst thing this show does is it tries to overcomplicate a very simple setup. And that narration from beyond the grave, you know, we've seen it in other productions before, mostly in film. I kept thinking of The Lovely Bones, actually. It's not good. It can be a little bit corny. It's a little bit cheesy. You're spoiling things from the outset. And it, as I said, there is a very simple setup here, but it keeps overcomplicating it with these surreal scenes and flashbacks. Almost at times feels like there are dream sequences in there.
There's a lot of dreams.
Yeah, the dream sequences, Jen. I mean, this brings us from the 60s, which all looks incredible in Baltimore, back to the 40s and Natalie Portman's character in the 40s as a child. Is that too much? Is that a step too far?
It's all a step too far because I think what the showrunner Alma Harrell is trying to do is she wants to ask a lot of her audience. It's big on atmosphere. It's big on atmospherics. It's big on thematics rather than this tight story that it could have been. And that's where it falls down. And that's where it will frustrate viewers because it's a very impressionistic piece. It's, you know,
there's a lot of beauty in it.
Definitely. There's bucket loads of stunning scenes. Like there really is. But at the same time, it's at the expense of a story that could have been opened out. And I think, you know, what they're aiming for is like David Lynch style, like a David Lynch style protagonist, especially with Natalie Portman's character, but shot through with this social realism that you're getting from Cleo's character as well. And but also, I think, you know, Natalie Portman, as we're saying, she starts at 20 and then she never stops going in this performance. And she's a bit like a zombified Joan from Mad Men, which I found really annoying. Like there's not enough in Maddie's character to make her three dimensional at all, and it doesn't work in that way.
Okay, we have two episodes down. They're dropping every Friday, so we'll have episode three this Friday. Stars, Chris?
A great performance from Moses Ingram, but the storytelling really leaves a lot to be desired. So it's 2.5 stars.
2.5 from Chris. And you, Jen?
Yeah, I mean, I would nearly tip to 3 because I'd really like people to see those beautiful set pieces that will leave your jaw on the floor, but story-wise, very disappointing.
So many stars again?
I would say 3. I'm going to go for 3.
Okay. That is Lady in the Lake, as I said, episode 3. You'll catch on Friday. Now, as we gear up for Gladiator 2, starring Paul Mescal, Prime Video brings us their own ancient Roman drama on the small screen with those about to die. Chris, you wait for one Gladiator and then another one appears very quickly. Good timing on this.
It is good timing, yeah. It has a few months to actually have the whole Roman Empire fix all to itself. But the Manix novel from 1958 was actually the novel that inspired inspired Ridley Scott's this, Ridley Scott's Gladiator, but they went a different route with it. To try and summarize the plot from this is to risk your head falling off your shoulders. But let's just say that there's something in there about an emperor. We've got Anthony Hopkins, you know, bringing a little bit of gravitas. You know, compared to the other actors that are involved in this, he's probably the best thing. But he's an aging emperor who is struggling to decide which of his idiot sons basically should take the throne. Should it be the warrior Titus Vivianus, played by Tom Hughes, who's this mopey general? The father doesn't approve of his love affair with, quote, this Judean queen. Or should it be Jojo McCarry's Domitian Flavius, who is the sociopathic head of Rome's gladiatorial contests?
Okay.
And he really should not be anywhere near, you know, the emperor's chair. We've also got, we're following Ian Rion's Texan, who is the head, who runs a betting tavern in Rome. And really, he'll do anything to kind of sit among, you know, the richest and the most powerful in Roman society. There is a mother trying to, who comes from Numidia and travels to Rome to try and win back her children, who have been, you know, basically bought into slavery. There's so much
happening.
It's about 2 hours into this thing before the story actually settles and the program begins.
Really? Okay. Yeah. 140 million of a budget here. Tell me it's, you know, Colosseum and bells and whistles and it all looks great and lots
it
of action sequences.
It doesn't look great. It really doesn't.
No.
There's an over-reliance on CGI in this show, and those big battling moments that you want to see in the Colosseum, those chariot races, those, you know, warrior against warrior fights, it ends up really looking so flat. And those crowd sequences, they just zoom in on certain patches of the crowd where they have the extras, and when they pull back, everybody looks the same, or everybody looks out of focus, everyone looks a bit blurry, and it looks like this a video game really. And then as the other scenes where, you know, you're supposed to have the dramaturgy that is happening, it is just this, you're covered in gloom. It was like sludgy browns and reds. You could barely see what was going on or who was in bed with who, because that's a big thing in this show, P.S. Like, they do like this. It's like they're trying to do this Game of Thrones, definitely like hone in on even having Ewan Thomas there is like a nod to, like, you know, we're going to sexy up and Game of Thrones up the Romans for people. And it just, for me, it sounded like a lot of placeholder dialogue as well. But you want that Machiavellian behind the scenes machinations. You want the biting kind of successionness of it all. And you don't get that at all. It literally is like this dialogue will do and people will lap it up.
Hey, let's take a little clip here. We meet Anthony Hopkins playing the aging emperor, speaking before the gladiators fight.
The telling of history is but a history of war. Not only those fought on battlefields, waged with whispers in palaces, or before the crowds in the arenas. Citizens of Rome, place your bets well, for there are those about to rise and those about to die.
And that's the title, Those About to Die, and that was Anthony Hopkins. Surely, Chris, Anthony Hopkins has to bring things up a notch or two. We love Anthony,
well,
right?
Yeah, I mean, he is like, he's doing his Anthony Hopkins bit here, and he is probably the best thing about it, but he's, you know, there's not an awful lot of him in it.
Okay.
And I don't think we're going to get that more of him. As I said, he is an aging emperor. He is on his way out. This is actually, we should say, from Roland Emmerich. You know, Independence Day Emmerich, Day After Tomorrow 2012 Emmerich.
So it should work, should it?
I wasn't going to say that, but you know, even at his worst, you know, his epic films, you know, he was the master of disaster. He's used to kind of throwing all the bells and whistles in there, you know, these epic set pieces, digital backdrops, huge ensembles, knotted storylines. Even at his worst, there's always something. There's always something that charms us. Or there's always some sort of special effect where you're sitting there thinking, how did they do that? With this, I was just confused. I was a little bit, you know, overwhelmed by the amount of kind of story coming at me. But, you know, I couldn't really make sense of, like, why all of these characters are connected or where at what point that they'll be connected.
I think if they just pushed with one or two storylines.
There's too much going on.
Yeah, there's way too much going on. I think Ewan Rion's character is like the most interesting in a way, 10X, because he's from like the underclasses. And if it just had been his journey versus like Anthony Hopkins' family, it might have been something.
What about now for the sensitive types in terms of violence and gore? Is this full on?
There is a bit of violence in there, but it's nothing that we haven't seen in Game of Thrones, a show that it so desperately wants to be. There's an awful lot of sex in there too, but again, nothing compared to Game of Thrones. It's actually just to go back to something Jen said, it's the special effects that really lets it down, because this is a prime show. They had more than $140 million to work with. There are times where I thought, give me a week on a graphic design course and I think I could do better than some of the visuals.
So we're not seeing
here.
The money on screen.
It's really not good enough. No, clearly the money was going to Anthony Hopkins because it wasn't going into how good the show how it looks.
He signed up for it though, didn't he?
He did.
He's a great Hannibal Lecter himself.
Okay, so I think we're waiting for Paul Mescal. Are we joining the stars?
I'm going to wait for Paul Mescal in all his glory in his skirt.
Yes.
So I would give this a 2, unfortunately.
A 2, okay. And Chris?
Yeah, I think wait until November to get your Roman Empire fix. 2 stars.
Paul Mescal, we shall wait for him. So thank you to Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon. Thanks so much for coming in this evening. And a reminder of the series we discussed tonight, all 10 episodes of Elsbeth are available on Sky Max and Now TV. The Lady in the Lake is streaming on Apple TV. Episode 3 drops on Friday. And Those About to Die is out now on Prime Video. And welcome back to Wednesday Night's Arena. Aideen Gormley here with you. Now, last Sunday marked the 110th anniversary of one of cinema's most prolific and greatest screenwriters. Suso Cecchi D'Amico was born in Rome on July 21st, 1914. And throughout a career that spanned some 60 years, she wrote or co-wrote over 130 films, including classics like Bicycle Thieves, The Leopard and Roman Holiday. And here to talk about D'Amico's career and indeed some of the many influential films she worked on is Stephen Benedict. Welcome, Stephen. And, you know, sometimes when we talk about filmmakers, there's that tendency, isn't there, to focus on the stars or the director.
Yeah.
But we're talking about a very special screenwriter. Give us a little background on her.
Yeah, well, Suso Cecchi D'Amico spent decades working on not just some of the greatest films ever to emerge from Italian cinema, but also some of the greatest films ever made. And throughout that career, she worked with some of the greatest Italian film directors who weren't just the greatest Italian filmmakers. They were some of the greatest filmmakers in the history of cinema. So get out your pencil and write out a long list and sharpen it. Federico Fellini, Luchino Visconti, Michelangelo Antonioni, Vittorio De Sica, Mario Monticelli, Francesco Rossi. And as you mentioned, Bicycle Thieves and The Leopard. Mm. And they are held, in the BFI recent survey, they are held up as one of the most 100 greatest films ever made. And over the course of her career, as you said, she worked on 130 screenplays which were published, which went into production. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about scripts that weren't made. 130 that went into production. So there was rarely a time where one of her scripts was not in production in Rome's celebrated Cinecittà Studios. To the point, I mean, she was such a colossus that she was affectionately referred to as La Regina di Cinecittà, the Queen of Cinecittà. So that's,
it's extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah. And an interesting time in terms of when she was born. We're talking Rome, 1914. So this means she grew up under the yoke of fascism, and that must have impacted her career. So how did she get started?
Well, this is where it gets a little bit complicated, because her father, Emilio Cecchi, was a prominent figure in the Italian film industry at the time. And he was appointed to a state-run studio. Now, you didn't get appointed to that sort of position in fascist Italy without declaring some sort of affiliation or loyalty to the party. So there is this this quandary in her parents' lineage. But when it comes to Cecchi D'Amico herself, her credentials cannot be questioned, because what happened was it was through her father working in the industry that then she got a little bit of an introduction to work hanging around the studios. And it was there that she met a young man named Lele D'Amico. And Lele was a musicologist, but he was also a fervent anti-fascist.
Okay.
And so they met, they fell in love and they got married and they had three children. But when the war broke out, he had to flee to Switzerland, where he contracted tuberculosis and had to sit out the war, which meant that Suso herself had to sit back in Italy and take care of the children, rear them all on her own, and then at the time try to get her career going. So it wasn't until really after the war that she was able to get any sort of career going. But as I said, her father had this questionable affiliation, but the thing was, when she went to start writing screenplays, the screenplays that she wrote were the very type of films that would never have been made under fascist Italy.
Yeah.
She was addressing issues that were forbidden under Mussolini's reign.
Now, as you mentioned, she's credited as writer or co-writer of over 130 films. I mean, incredibly prolific. Several films which Suso Cecchi D'Amico worked on where she didn't then receive a credit. One of those, one of the most popular movies ever made.
Yeah, this is again quite complicated. The movie in question is the film that introduced the world to Audrey Hepburn. I'm talking about Roman Holiday.
Yeah.
And the thing was that the film was originally written by Dalton Trumbo, and he had been blacklisted by the Hollywood studios because of his affiliation with the Communist Party in America. And so the script was actually fronted by two writers, Ian McClellan Hunter and John Dighton. And it was submitted to the studio, and they said yes, and they said, let's go off and make the movie. But when the script was handed to William Wyler, the director, he went through it and he says, this isn't authentic enough, because I've actually been to Rome. He served with the US Air Force during World War II, and he had been to Rome, and he says, this doesn't feel authentic at all, and I want to Romanize it. So it was he who hired in Suzo Cecchi D'Amico.
Okay.
And she came up with scenes that actually turn out to be some of the most celebrated scenes in the movie, which is the chase on the Vespa.
Yeah.
And then the moment where it looks like Gregory Peck has lost his hand in the mouth of truth. But then most charming of all is the scene where Audrey Hepburn, where she's playing the Crown Princess Anne from a non-specific European country as a state visit to Italy. She slips from the grip of her charges, and she wants to see Rome all by herself. And so she inadvertently winds up in the company of a scheming American journalist played by Gregory Peck. She goes back to his apartment, and then she pretends to be a little bit drunk, and she has to put on his pyjamas to spend the night there, which is all very risque in 1950.
It is very risque. We have a clip from that very scene from Roman Holiday. So Hepburn, as you say, playing a crown princess in disguise, has to spend the night in the apartment of Gregory Peck's journalist, who's hoping to get a scoop for the American newspapers back home. And as you say, risque. I think it's even more risque when you hear it as opposed to seeing it and watching it. Yeah. So let's take a listen.
Can I have a silk nightgown with rosebuds on it?
I'm afraid you'll have to rough it tonight. In these.
Pajamas.
Sorry, honey, but I haven't worn a nightgown in years.
Will you help me get undressed, please?
Okay. There you are. You can handle the rest.
This is very unusual. I've never been alone with a man before, even with my dress on. With my dress off, it's most unusual. I don't seem to mind. Do you?
Yeah, as we say, quite risque, isn't it? Audrey Hepburn and Gregory Peck there trying to navigate a rather awkward situation in the classic romantic comedy Roman Holiday. And Stephen, as you say, Suzo Cecchi D'Amico had a crucial input there, but no credit.
Yeah, I mean, the irony about that film is that the movie actually ended up being nominated for 8 Academy Awards, one of which was for Best Original Screenplay. McClellan Hunter and Dighton were credited and they were given the nomination, and neither Cecchi D'Amico nor Dalton Trumbo, who wrote the original screenplay, were given. But in the years since, Trumbo has had his credit restored, but Cecchi D'Amico has still been wiped off.
It is complicated, as you say. Yeah. Let's come to one of the great works of that neorealist movement in the 1948 film Bicycle Thieves.
Yeah, now this is really interesting because despite, you know, Mussolini's proclamations when he was in power, Italy was really, really poor. It was a destitute country and morally stunted as well. And the education system was so poor that the vast majority of the population, or a sizable proportion of the population, couldn't even read. And so when the war ended, it was the marginalised groups that the neorealists wanted to put front and centre in the film. The people who had been completely ignored by the Mussolini regime. And so the movie Bicycle Thieves addresses that destitution. And it, for me, the movie Bicycle Thieves houses the greatest screenplay ever written.
Okay. That's quite saying something.
Yeah. Now, I find the movie extraordinarily moving. So if it sounds like I'm going to cry, I am crying. The thing is that it's adapted from a book. It was actually a satire by Luigi Bartolini. And when Vittorio De Sica decided to direct the picture, he brought in a team of writers. Now, I want to stress, as you said at the beginning, she co-wrote many of the scripts, but basically she co-wrote. But it was her idea to change the ending of the film, because the book ends on a very, very upbeat, happy ending. And if anyone has seen Bicycle Thieves, the ending is complete devastation. And it wasn't the first film to go for the ambiguous ending, but it was the first film with such power that delivered an ambiguous ending. And people have been copying it ever since. Now, I'm going to just quickly relate the plot. Okay. Now, some of your listeners may say that sounds like a bunch of cliches. It's a bunch of cliches because so many films have copied it. It's like saying Hamlet is cliche.
Okay, it got there first.
Yes, exactly. So the story is about a poverty-stricken family in post-war Rome, and the unemployed father is offered a job putting up film posters, but he needs a bicycle. He doesn't have a bicycle, so the family is so poor that they have to pawn the family linen. They pawn the linen, he gets the bike, and on the first day of putting up the posters, the bike is stolen, and he must embark on a quest with his son to find the bike. Otherwise, everybody starves. Excuse the pun, but the brilliant thing about this film is the bicycle is just the vehicle. Sorry.
Okay.
in which the movie is able to navigate post-war Rome, and it navigates also the post-war social landscape. So the father goes off on a quest, wandering through the city. Does this sound like Ulysses? I wonder. Okay, but by doing so, the film examines the city's social fabric. And then as the father encounters these institutions, such as the law and the church, and nobody helps, nobody's helping at all, you encounter the apathy of people. And that's what he's up against, is not only the institutions, but the excuse that people use the past as human behaviour. So if anyone has seen The Ending, if anyone hasn't seen The Ending, prepare yourself. It's absolutely superb.
OK, we're going to have a little clip from Bicycle Thieves, which obviously was originally made in Italian, but since we've no subtitles on radio, we've got a dubbed version in English here.
There's an opening here for a turner, but you don't know Lee.
All I know is I can't eat garbage, so you have to find something for us.
There's just no work for you people.
Don't you understand?
Hey, Richie, don't you understand? Don't forget to take your bicycle. You need a bicycle. It's written on the slip. You do have one.
A bicycle? I do have one. Only it's broke. At the end of the week, I pick it up.
Hey, no, you need it this morning. It's on the slip there.
But I'll walk for a while. I'll be doing the work. It's the same thing.
Look, Richie, it calls for you to have a bicycle, or I give the job to somebody else.
I got a bicycle.
Hey, do you call that something? I got one.
Come on.
Yeah, a clip there from the Italian neorealist masterpiece Bicycle Thieves, albeit dubbed into English. Stephen, we have to mention The Leopard, don't we? Another literary adaptation and another radical change from Susa Cecchi D'Amico in her script.
Yes, The Leopard was originally a novel by Giuseppe de Lampedusa, and it's sort of the Italian equivalent of Dr. Zhivago or Gone with the Wind. The book that chronicles the unification or the massive turning point in one country's history. And when Luchino Visconti went to make the picture, he hired in a team of writers, but it was again Cecchi D'Amico who came up with this fantastic idea. The movie actually went on to win the Palme d'Or at the 1963 Cannes Film Festival. And what Cecchi D'Amico did was she decided to condense the last 40 pages, count them, she condensed 40 pages down to one scene. Okay.
Wow.
Now, admittedly, it's an extended scene, but what she decided to do was she very famously said that you write with your eyes for screenplays.
Yeah.
And so she decided to visualise the last 40 pages, the tone and the theme of the last 40 pages. And what she did was she decided to create this magnificent ball, the state ball, is to celebrate the unification of Italy. And the whole story is about an aristocratic family where the head of the family is concerned that the Garibaldi's men is unifying Italy will actually strip him of his power. So what she does is, in this fantastic ball sequence at the end, is she unites the newly formed politicians with the aristocrats, and they just simply dance. And there's a few little conversations here and there and pockets and all this sort of stuff. But you see Burt Lancaster, who plays the Don, and his son, played by Alain Delon, who's now married a middle-class lady, played by Claudia Cardinale, which is the consolidation of the emerging middle class with the aristocracy, which means the new power, which means nothing is going to change. But what Cecchi D'Amico's brilliant idea was, have them dancing the waltz, and it goes on and on and on. And because they're dancing in circles, it never goes anywhere. There's no political change at all. The unification of Italy has brought nothing about. And the brilliant thing was, the movie's released in 1963, 100 years after the unification of Italy. It was Visconti and the team of writers and Cecchi D'Amico were saying, this is what they were saying.
Gosh, well, this is a film in Italian again, so we don't have a clip, but let's have some music from the film to end on that waltz you mentioned. My thanks to you, Stephen. Stephen Benedict, talking us through the career of the legendary Italian screenwriter Susa Cecchi D'Amico, and here one of the waltzes from her famous ending to The Leopard, with the score composed by Nino Rota.
Thank you.
You're listening to Wednesday's Arena with Aideen Gormley. And finally tonight, the Mundy sisters from Donegal are back on stage at the Gate Theatre in Dublin as it revives Dancing at Lunasa, Brian Friel's memory play from 1990. Caroline Byrne directs a cast including Zara Devlin, Ruth McGill and Terence Keeley. And the central drama takes place in the summer of 1936. Helen Meaney went to see it for us and she's here with me now in studio. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you.
This is a much-loved play. As we know it, it premiered in the Abbey Theatre back in 1990. It proved an instant hit. It hit the West End and Broadway. It was last seen on the Gate stage 20 years ago. So in a way, a lot riding on this because it's so beloved and it's at this case, I suppose, a cornerstone of the canon of Irish theatre, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It has been. And it's actually hard to believe it's 20 years since it was at the Gate. And I saw it then in 2004. So where did those 20 years go? But it's a very fresh production directed by Caroline Byrne. And it works really well. And it was great to see it again. It felt as if a certain kind of hazy, nostalgic elements had been somewhat scraped off it. And there was a lovely clarity to this production and some beautiful ensemble playing and lovely staging and design.
That's an interesting point because I think sometimes when we hold a play so beloved and you say, you know, saw it 20 years ago on the Gate, many people say, remember the Abbey, you're going in with a lot of baggage in a way that you're going, please don't let them mess with it. Is it going to be okay? So you don't feel we have anything to worry about there.
Nothing to worry about, but it's interesting that question because it is a play about memory.
Yes.
And so it's about layers of memory. And so that now people who saw the 1990 fabled Abbey production, you know, they remember that. So there's another layer added to it. So yeah, it's very rich in that respect because it's now the past of the play, 1936, is really quite a long way from us now. Mm. And so there's that sense of a world in rural Donegal in 1936 when it's set that was on the cusp of change. But of course, so much has changed since then. So we've multiple ways of thinking about that past within the past.
So remind us of the setup here. We meet with Terence Keeley playing Michael, narrator, son of Chris, nephew of the Mundy sisters. And it's a role Gerard McSorley made his own in the original production. But that's as it sets up. So set up the play for us.
Yes, Michael is the narrator. His adult self is looking back on this summer of 1936 when he was a seven-year-old boy and he was being brought up kind of collectively, actually, by his mother and his four aunts in a cottage in the fictional place of a town of our area of Ballybeg, which is, Glenties, Donegal. And so he's, as an adult, trying to piece together what happened that summer and why it was so important in his memory. And it's because after that, everything changed in the family. But we don't know how reliable the memory of a seven-year-old boy is. And so the play is as much an exploration of that, is how we choose to remember things, what we choose to forget, and how that whole process works. So he's looking back at his aunts and his mother, and they are living together, unmarried siblings, really being kept sort of under quite sharp control by their elder sister Kate, and who's the only person earning any money in this family, and she's the national school teacher in the village, and is very much at the mercy of the whim of the parish priest. So it's a lot about that rather repressive side of Catholicism in the 1930s in the new Free State.
Mm. The whole look of it as we enter the Gate, tell us a little bit about the set, what we're looking at. And I think lighting is hugely important here too, isn't it?
It is. So the lighting design is by Paul Keoghan and it really creates an atmosphere. It's very warm. So we get that sense of a long August summer, not at all what we're experiencing now, but you know, we can imagine a lovely hot summer in Donegal. So the backdrop by Kiara Stevenson is the set and costume designer. It's a wheat field. It's just the outline of wheat as a backdrop of the entire stage. So that's almost abstract, and it's beautifully lit and almost burnished in the memory of Michael. You know, this could not have been how it was, but this is now moving
oranges
into,
and pinks and
into a kind of a dream state. So that's the abstract part. And then the front, you've got the more naturalistic interior of the cottage with the stove and the table and the dresser where the all-important wireless is set, the Marconi. They call it the Marconi radio. And that that's really, really important. So that's how the outside world comes into this very remote place.
Yeah,
and it's really, really important that the music really means everything to them.
It's the outside world, as you say. Let's talk about that dance scene. It is the all-important scene when they kick their feet up on hearing the trad music on the radio. I was interested to see how they were going to do this because Caroline Byrne was on Arena talking about looking back at Brian Friel's notes and that the dance wasn't as such joyous, but it was freedom, it was a release, it was getting away from it all and stopping for a while. So I saw Jean Butler as well noted on the credits. So what did they do with the dance?
I thought it was really well handled because the dance scene has become famous, you know, and it's what people most remember from the play. Mm. And it was also really influential in bringing movement and dance into Irish theatre. So we're all going to see this dance. And what was really well done was the sense that even though the sisters were dancing simultaneously, they weren't dancing together. Mm. They were all in their own world. They were all had their own individual forms of expression. And that was wonderful and quite true. And what it was an expression of, it looked in this production as an expression of anger, of defiance, of resistance, of frustration. And Kate in particular, she's the last one to join the dance, the elder sister who's trying to maintain probity at all points, the stages. And she joins in the dance as a step dance, trying to do the right thing. And then she just abandons that, runs out the back. And we see her in front of the wheat field, silhouetted and her arms up in the air, like reaching, beseeching, almost like someone who's drowning and saying, you know, help me, save me. It's quite distressing.
It is.
And it's very moving. And so they're all expressing something in their individual way. So it's not like they're holding hands and dancing around the table. Like there's nothing twee about this.
No, and then when it stops, they're all almost embarrassed. You know,
they come back to themselves and there's a sense of, oh, maybe they revealed too much there.
Exactly.
And a vulnerability and maybe even a sense of shame.
And movement, this dance aside, is hugely important, I think, in this production. As you say, even when they move out to this sort of dreamlike back of the stage, it goes into slow motion. It's beautifully done, isn't it? I think a lot of thought has been put into just the whole pacing of this production.
Yes, so the movement director is Sue Mylan, but also there's beautiful sound design throughout.
Yes.
And there's dance throughout and also the singing. So there's that sense of what Friel was talking about, what language cannot express, the things that go beyond verbal language. And that's one of the big themes of this play.
Let's come back to some more of the performances. It's a terrific ensemble play, Helen, isn't it? And, you know, I saw faces I knew there, like Ruth McGill as Kate, Peter McGowan as Father Jack, Zara Delvin as Chris. But I think I counted 5 Gate debuts. I loved seeing these new faces on stage.
Yes, and you know, it was really interesting how there's kind of distinct character delineation, but also precise individuality in the sisters, and particularly like Nikki Harley playing Agnes.
Mm.
Now, Agnes is the sister who has formed a huge attachment to Chris's, husband, the father of Chris's child, and Jerry. And so she's I think probably in love with him, and she's full of, you know, she's glowering and full of pain. And then there's a moment where he asks her to dance and she just blossoms. And those subtleties are lovely. Zara Devlin, was also in Friel's translation. And I think she's fantastic.
She's great, yeah.
But actually, I really loved Ruth McGill as Kate because it's a tightrope that she has to walk in that performance, but she plays it with some softness and we do sympathise with her even though she feels she needs to be very controlling. But it works really well as an ensemble. The other brilliant performance that we have to mention is Peter Gowan as Father Jack, the returned missionary who's gone slightly off piste, shall we say. Sort of ironic and bemused, and he's not as confused. Like, he hasn't lost his marbles or anything. He's actually just readjusting to being back in Donegal after 3 decades, I think, in Uganda. But he plays it beautifully and with a light touch, because that role can be played in a very caricaturish, kind of mad way. But actually, he holds a lot of the themes of the play about different types of spirituality and, you know, celebration and ritual and expression against, you know, orthodoxy and conformity. So he has to kind of carry a lot of that in what he's talking about the kind of rituals he's involved in Africa. So it's a great performance. I've never seen it done so well.
Yeah, I thought he was great in between the two. There is, as you say, that Christianity versus pagan, and that idea that all of the sisters mind each other, they have each other's backs, and they all adore young Michael. And then these other males in there, there's a disturbance still, though, from Father Jack, isn't there? And
then
Jerry comes in, and I think they all love the energy of a male, of Jerry in there.
They're
don't they?
Very attracted to Jerry in their own different ways.
Yeah, and that
is so moving, actually.
And some of it is so moving. I mean, there is comedy there, but the idea that in real life, two of Brian Friel's aunts did become destitute in England, and this inspired him to write this. I mean, it's heartbreaking.
It is, and there's the second half is much bleaker when we realise actually how poor they are, and they're living.
Yes.
It's a subsistence existence, and how precarious it is, and that's why the young Michael. That's why this is frozen, this particular moment in his memory, because that's when it all changes and the family breaks up essentially.
No, this fear and that poverty at the end. I mean, when they're making dinner and it's literally
three
eggs for eight people. It's extraordinary.
And some brown bread.
So to finish, Helen, in terms of us saying we remember the production 20 years ago and 30 years ago, Caroline Byrne's direction here, is it going to be that we'll say, do you remember the Gate production in 2024?
I think she really does justice to the Friel's themes, but also she declutters it, and I think that her attention to detail in performance, it does stand out.
Mm. Sounds like you're recommending it. Helen, thank you so much. Helen Meaney in studio with me tonight. Thank you so much. Dancing at Lunasa by Brian Friel is at the Gate Theatre in Dublin until the 21st of September. For further details, check out gatetheatre.ie.